Thanks so much, everybody, for coming out. Backspace. Okay, great. There we go. Bear with me a minute. So who knows what that is? Pachyderm, that's right. I've already broken the machinery. Yes, that is the elephant in the room. And does anybody recognize that particular elephant? Because it was roaming the halls of the Moon Palace, which is where the negotiations were going on. How much do you think it weighs? Up to 12 gigatons. That elephant weighs up to 12 gigatons. And the elephant represents one of the big elephants in the room, certainly not the only one, but one of the big elephants in the room during these negotiations, and that was something that came to be called the gigaton gap. And what is the gigaton gap? Well, in short, and Michelle referenced it, is when, you know, in Copenhagen, we made this agreement that we're going to limit warming to no more than 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees Celsius, and 2 degrees is, we think, not good enough. You know, we need to get down below 1.5, but we made this agreement. That's our goal. And then we made these pledges, and there's no relationship between the goals and the pledges. So it became known as a gap that needed to be moved toward closing in Cancun. That was one of the goals we certainly had. We didn't have illusions that we were going to close it, but we did have some hope that we might make some steps towards closing it. So how big is this gap? And the short answer is it's enormous. In Cancun, the United Nations Environment Program released a report called the Emissions Gap Report, and they put the gap at between 5 and 9 gigatons of carbon pollution in the year 2020, and some estimates have been as high as 12 gigatons. And this is just a little graph to explain like how far off we are. So you can see in 2020, we really should be at about 40 gigatons of carbon that year to get down to 350. Yet on this pledge track, we're looking at far more. And if you look at the Copenhagen pledges, you know, really out of Copenhagen, there should be a move to start a new organization called 650.org. But let's hope they don't actually start that because make our work more difficult. So how big is all of that? All of those numbers, right? What do they mean? So at best, this gap is 5 gigatons, which is about equal to all of the world emissions from all the world's cars, trucks, and buses in 2005. That's the best number. 7 gigatons is about the size of the entire annual emissions from the U.S., all the different industries. And it could be as large as the emissions of Russia and China combined. So what does that mean in terms of temperature? So those are like numbers around gigatons, billions of tons of carbon. But what does it mean for temperature? And this is another graph which shows the green zone there represents trajectories needed to stay below 2 degrees Celsius warming. And the vertical bar that's there is the range of pledges, and it expresses a range because the pledges put on the table in Copenhagen were some were unconditional, like no matter what, we're going to cut carbon by X percent, and some were conditional. Well, we may go a little bit higher if country Y does X and Z, or if finance works out this way, or there were conditional pledges. So it's also a range there. But the green zone is the safe zone. The red zone represents temperature rises of between 4 and 5 degrees Celsius, and the purple zone is temperature rises above 5 degrees Celsius. So one of the great ironies and sad ironies was that the countries in Copenhagen really did bury their heads in the sand, and this actually was taken in Cancun, and that is not Copenhagen, that is Cancun. And really to illustrate the fact that one of the most important things at stake here was not under discussion in the text. At one point, there was a move just to put in language recognizing this gap. Hey, you know, you've got a problem here. Your goal and your solution don't come anywhere near meshing. So there was a move to do that and put in place some studies, and that did not go anywhere. So The short version of this story is that this elephant in the room is going to be traveling to Durban, and we will see him there next year, this year, I guess. There were several things that could have taken place in Cancun. We talked a little bit about this toward closing the gap. There were also a lot of loopholes. One of the big ones at issue was what I'll call the logging loophole, which basically developed countries were seeking a framework that would allow them to increase logging and draining of wetlands without reporting these emissions anywhere under any of the different tracks. That was not decided. That issue remains open. Another issue that remains open is carryover of unused emissions credits from the first Kyoto commitment period to the second commitment period. That issue, some countries, Russia and Ukraine in particular, were seeking to carry over those unused credits to the new period. That's open. So these are some of the ways that we could have moved toward closing the gap there, but did not. And so we have definitely have our work set out for us. I want to move from this very grim situation where we're looking at temperature rise that is just catastrophic. It's beyond what I can actually think about and continue to function. But to what's going on here a little bit in the U.S. and relate it to what happened in Cancun. So what we hear from the U.S. negotiators constantly is like, is during these briefings that they have, which are horrible, they will tell you, we really want to do more. Yes, we do, but you know, we can't. And particularly after the shift in Congress, I mean, they are just like, you can't look to us to do anything. Look what happened in Congress. Like, you failed to get the Democrats elected, so you know, you are suffering the consequences. We can't do more. And so what we hear, and this is from Jonathan Pershing, one of the negotiators in for the U.S. delegation, is just we're not going to do anything that's unmeetable technically or that we can't pass politically. And this is a falsehood. This is a false excuse for not acting. Thank you. It is. It's a complete falsehood. It's a complete falsehood because we in the U.S. actually have some of the strongest environmental laws already on our books, right? That we could be using boldly, ambitiously, and urgently to curb carbon pollution now. The good news is that we're starting to use those laws. The bad news is that we're not using them aggressively enough yet as we need to. And I'm gonna talk in my last few minutes about our current best chance here in the US to curb carbon pollution, and that's the Clean Air Act. So the Clean Air Act was signed by the man on the left, not the man on the right. And it's protected the air we breathe here for 40 years. And it's our most important and successful air pollution control law. It's really simple. It requires the Environmental Protection Agency to identify and regulate major sources of pollution to ensure that they are reduced to levels that do not endanger human health and welfare. That's the purpose of the Clean Air Act. It's been extremely successful. It's reduced pollutants by different pollutants by between 47 and 93%. Airborne lead's been virtually eliminated. It saved thousands of lives, improved health, decreased the cases of asthma and cancer. And it's done this all while our economy has flourished. So you're going to hear a lot in these fights around the Clean Air Act, how the world will stop if we enforce the Clean Air Act to curb carbon pollution. And looking at the record of the Clean Air Act, it's very clear that while growth, all of these things have gone up, the pollutants regulated under the Clean Air Act, that last line, have gone down. And we've been fine. Actually, there's been calculations that the Clean Air Act, the benefits of the Clean Air Act have been 42 times the cost of regulation. So I want to tell you a little bit about how the Clean Air Act works, because the Clean Air Act is under attack precisely because it is so powerful and could be so powerful to curb carbon pollution. It's under attack, and we need to know what's at stake in these fights. So bear with me. You're going to get the 3-minute version of the Clean Air Act. This is the fastest version ever. The Clean Air Act works through two basic things. It regulates stationary sources of pollution and mobile sources of pollution, things like cars, trucks, trains, etc. It works in this way. We're back to the elephant theme here. which is for years, there's been a move to use the Clean Air Act to curb carbon pollution. So the Clean Air Act curbs a number of traditional pollutants, right? Sulfur dioxide, lead, mercury, all of these things. And there's been a move to get them to use the Clean Air Act to curb carbon pollution. And after many years of litigation, it went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. So when you hear about EPA power grabs, EPA's power grabbing, these other things, actually they were ordered to do this by the conservative US Supreme Court. In 2007, in this case, the Supreme Court ruled, hey, greenhouse gases are air pollutants under that definition of the Clean Air Act I just read you. EPA has authority to regulate them, and EPA's next step is to determine whether they endanger health and welfare, and if they do, then they must be regulated. So during the Bush administration, they just kind of sat on that, but Obama did run on a promise to move forward with this, and in late 2009, the Obama administration did issue what is called the endangerment finding. It found that, hey, greenhouse gases endanger our public health and welfare. And from there, we're moving to regulation. We're moving to curbing greenhouse gas pollution under the Clean Air Act. There are three main programs of the Clean Air Act, and I want to tell you where we are with them right now in terms of curbing carbon pollution. The first one is called New Source Review, and it's pretty simple. If you have a new source of pollution, or you're doing a major modification, so it's a new adding a great deal of carbon pollution, you need to go through this permitting system with EPA. You need to use the best available technology to curb carbon pollution. And on January 2nd, 2011, like 2 weeks ago, the EPA finally started using this program of the Clean Air Act. And that's a really big deal. That can be a really big deal. On the flip side, when the EPA agreed to do this, they also issued what is called the tailoring rule. So they started with the big sources of carbon pollution first, which we supported, but they also exempted many large sources from regulation, which we did not support. The next program of the Clean Air Act is called the New Source Performance Standard. And this one sets an industry-wide standard on the amount of pollution different industries may emit. So it kind of sets a floor by industry. And what's significant about this program, it doesn't just apply to new sources of carbon pollution, it also applies to existing sources as well. And again, EPA is doing some stuff to move this forward. Just last month, the EPA announced it was going to settle a lawsuit around implementing these rules for carbon pollution, and it's going to begin to set a timeline to regulate refineries and power plants, which is a big source of carbon pollution. So that's great, but they also exempted cement plants, which they shouldn't have done, because look at those cement plants. The final program I'm going to talk about is probably the most controversial one, but we like to call this the cap without the trade. It's it's called National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NAAQS, if you want to be a wonk about it. We call it the National Pollution Cap Program because that's what it is. It requires the EPA for certain pollutants to set a cap using the best available science, to not look at costs. Regulation does not come in. You use science, you set a cap, and you work with the states to meet that cap. And we definitely think that that carbon pollution, greenhouse gas pollution, meet this requirement. And we did petition the EPA in 2009, along with our partner 350.org, to apply this section of the Clean Air Act. So they have not responded to this petition, which is not unusual, but we continue to press this. The final thing I'll say is we do see the Clean Air Act as our current best chance to curb global warming, but it is really under attack. So we both need to save the Clean Air Act. We think the best way to save the Clean Air Act is to use the Clean Air Act and show that the world does not end when you use the Clean Air Act to curb carbon pollution, and in fact, it's a very effective tool. So if folks are interested in getting involved and becoming one of our Clean Air Act advocates in 2011, that's my information, and thanks so much for coming out tonight.